I've been trying to interview Professor Edward Wilson for, well, probably most of my career as a journalist, to be honest, and finally got the chance, unfortunately just over the phone, because he was supposed to be coming to speak at an event on Tuesday last week, which was the 150th anniversary of the publication of On the Origin of Species. He was speaking at supposed to be speaking at this event at the Royal Institution. Unfortunately, he was not able to come, and he delivered his lecture via video link, but we spoke over the phone, and he had a lot to say about the biodiversity crisis that's happening at the moment, and the fact that he thinks it's being crowded out somewhat by the attention that global warming is getting. Can you describe the scale of the biodiversity crisis that we're in at the moment?
Immense and hidden. The reason I use those words is that the amount of biodiversity on the planet is enormous. We could, excluding microorganisms, have eventually find 20 or 30 million species, if we were to include all of the small invertebrates, especially, whereas we know only 1.9 million, enough to have a scientific name and a diagnosis. So most of the, with certainty, most of the life forms on Earth are unknown yet to science at the species level. Microorganisms, when we finally break in thoroughly into their variety with the use of DNA sequencing, which is now increasingly advanced, well enough, in fact, to characterize more and more species, may add tens of millions of more species. At the present time, we have only the vaguest idea of the diversity of bacteria and other microorganisms. That's what we're embarking on now. I made a point, in addition to the talk I'm giving through video, that a major initiative of biology in this century is going to be mapping the world's biodiversity. So I said it's immense and it's hidden, meaning most of it's unknown, but it's also threatened. And we know from the best studied groups of organisms, and these, of course, are, for the most part, the vertebrates, the big animals and the plants, flowering plants, that extinction rates are on the order, at the present time, through human activity, 1,000 times what they were before the coming of modern people. The rate, very crudely or very roughly, before humanity began its spread, after the greatly increased the population with the beginning of the Neolithic, the extinction rate was probably about one species per million species per year. Now we've upped that 1,000 times, and I think most people working on biodiversity issues would agree that because it's likely increasing at an accelerating rate, it could easily be 10,000 before very long, before too many years, say, or a couple of decades.
So at a fairly conservative estimate, are we talking about 20 to 30,000 species a year that we're losing?
Oh, yes. And the point is that we only know a few groups of organisms, like birds and flowers and so on, to make that estimate. So if you extend it to other organisms, kinds of organisms, insects especially, but also all those teeming tiny creatures few people have ever heard of that make up a large part of the soil, then you can imagine that there are species extinctions going on in an absolute measure, greater than anything we've really put our mind to examine.
Is it possible? I mean, I don't really expect you to have this figure on the top of your head, but is it possible to put even the vaguest figure on the number of species we've lost since Darwin did his epic journey around the world on the Beagle?
That would be a real mathematical challenge. I could not, but it would be a very great many.
I suppose if
and see, here's another aspect of it, that growing numbers of species, and you can see this happening in especially freshwater fish, but also in amphibians, where rates are, that is, the percentage of threatened species that we know about, species threatened with extinction, are up at the 25% level. That the number of species that are ready to be tipped over into extinction around the world, therefore, is very high, and more are being added to that list of endangered every year, because we destroy, especially as we destroy habitats. For example, we don't know, have any idea how many species of plants and animals were put into the threatened list, in addition to going extinct in a place like the like the Cerrado, C-E-R-R-A-D-O, you know, the savanna of Brazil, which is being converted swiftly to agriculture. So, but I'd say a very large number have gone extinct in absolute numbers, and I wouldn't want to venture a guess of what percentage that is of the whole.
Of the order of hundreds of thousands,
I would
rather
think
than
so,
tens
yeah.
of thousands.
Yes, I would think so.
And I mean, what do you think Darwin would have thought about that if he was if he could be transported to our time now?
He would be appalled. Darwin would be one of our foremost conservationists if he were alive today.
Are there any specific examples that you can think of that he studied on the Beagle voyage? Again, I don't really expect you to have this at the front of your mind, but I don't know if there are any that come to mind that are in the Beagle voyage book that are now no longer with us.
That's a really good question. I haven't, you know, who's I haven't thought sorted through, even though I did this big Darwin anthology. I believe if I sat down and thought of species that Darwin was familiar with and have declined in numbers or even gone extinct, there would be some you'd find in this thing. Perhaps Darwin's rhea, you know, the big ostrich-like bird, one species of the big ostrich-like bird. So on. I'll pass on that one.
Okay, that's fair enough. So what should we be doing to halt this appalling loss of species?
Let me relate it then to the Darwin, the sesquicentennial, 150-year anniversary of that we're about to celebrate. It is that until people, and particularly media and intellectuals generally, and then the public, see life on this planet as it actually is, how it was created, how long it took to create it, and the risk that so much of it, this diversity, is in now, until they understand that in terms of evolutionary history, in other words, in terms of what their inheritance is and why they have that inheritance and what it means to them through the kind of science that's been developed since The Origin was published, until that is accomplished, we're going to move very slowly. So slowly we're going to lose far more species than was necessary. That's the link to Darwin. Darwin taught us how that diversity was created. And he gave us a much better sense of humanity. In fact, this was his primary contribution. It could be summarized as follows. Humanity is a biological species in a biological world. People, most people don't think of themselves and the species that way, think of themselves, humanity, that way, but they should, in order to see that this is their home, and they were created here in the same process that created all the diversity around them. They're perfectly adapted to it, and they really ought to be saving it.
You mentioned just now that Darwin would be our greatest conservationist if he was alive today. What would he advocate? What would he say we should be doing?
Well, I couldn't answer that because, you know, it depends on the context of the culture and how well people they're being taught at Cambridge these days. That was supposed to be semi-humorous. But anyway, the point is that, we don't know. You couldn't duplicate Darwin today. We have lots of young men and women now with comparable dedication, but they can't develop the way Darwin did. There is no equivalent of opportunity like the Voyage of the Beagle, or positions, lifelong time positions that Darwin in effect had at Downhouse, to allow years and years of contemplation and work. So the Darwin of today would be probably a quite different person. He would be on the scholarly side and working hard to explain the process of species formation, and he would undoubtedly be an ecologist. Darwin was already in the process of formulating a science of ecology, particularly community ecology. I think he would be an ardent proponent.
On a sort of related tack, I mean, as you know, we're days away from the beginning of the Copenhagen Climate Summit, and many people, well, certainly did have great hopes, even if they've been somewhat downgraded, of a major deal between nations that will cut carbon emissions. And of course, global warming is one of many factors that is leading to biodiversity loss. Do you have a view as to what ought to happen at Copenhagen? I mean, obviously, it's not a scientific question; it's more a geopolitical question. But you know, do you think the nations are being ambitious enough?
No, not by a long shot. I want to tell you about that. There has developed a serious disproportion in the environment movement with reference to the physical environment and the living environment. That is, the world is waking up to the overall environmental changes that are occurring rapidly. But our minds are primarily on the physical environment, that which gives us a direct support, you know, visible, and also has certain aesthetic qualities. Everyone knows now the climate is changing substantially due to human activity, and everyone is concerned about pollution and the exhaustion of non-replaceable resources and so on. These are parts of the physical environment, but there's also the living environment. That's the rest of life. And that has sort of taken ease off center stage. And we don't hear as much public concern, protestations and plans by political leaders and so on to save the living environment. But now what I'm going to do, and it doesn't get anything like the attention the physical environment does, but now I'm going to state something that I've been modestly calling Wilson's Law in applied ecology as the following. If you save the living environment, conserve biodiversity, then you will automatically save the physical environment, because you can't save the living environment without substantially preserving the productive parts of the physical environment. But, the law continues, if you save only the physical environment, then you will ultimately lose them both, because the living environment is vital for the sustaining of those parts of the physical environment in which humanity lives and depend, and on which it depends. For example, rather than just go into a list of it, but it provides, for example, the services, the ecological services on which we absolutely depend, from the cleansing and the holding of our water to the creation of soil, to the production even of the atmosphere. And we haven't woken up to the fact that there's a strong linkage between the two. That is, saving the environment as we perceive it, mostly on the physical side, but also equally on the living side. I think Darwin, if he'd worried about those issues, and they were then apparent in Victorian England when the Origin was written, and then his other great books, I think he would have come down hard on the need for including the living environment in all of our future efforts.
What do you think a successful deal at Copenhagen would look like? Or are you saying that the entire way the question's being framed is not correct?
Oh, I don't think Copenhagen, that is, focusing on the climate change, is going to have more than a marginal attention to the very deep and complex issues concerning biodiversity. I hope they realize that to mitigate effects of climate change, they have to know how all of this is affecting the living environment, you know, and concerning the amount and the future of biodiversity. But I rather doubt that that's going to be a major issue at Copenhagen.
But it should be. How does one get those issues in front of leaders when they're making those kind of decisions?
I think that there's a case to be made for creating an initiative, and I don't know exactly how this would gather more strength and momentum, but there's a powerful case to be made for creating the equivalent of the IPCC for the living environment. That is to define what it is we need to know about the living environment to save it more precisely than has been attempted, and include in this program a much stronger effort to estimate the numbers of species, and then extend the work of the IUCN and other world organizations that are trying to explore biodiversity on Earth and protect it, extend their effort into exploratory studies of the nature and the amount of biodiversity and what's happening and the like. Incidentally, I'm just composing a book, an article, which we will, which I hope we will be able to place in a prominent journal calling for just this effort. And my partner in this is at the University of Bath. He's the head of the species survival program of the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And we'll call it, the effort we're calling for could be given a name like the Barometer of Life. You might want to talk with him about that. And because, as I said, this is just an article in the late stage of writing. I believe that that's the kind of effort that really would result in solid progress in taking better care of the living environment. By that I mean biodiversity.
And so what you're proposing is an organization a bit like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which, as you know, has thousands of scientists and economists and people like that who would define the science of what we know about biodiversity and what we need to know.
That's exactly right.
Right.
That's what we need to do.
Okay.
We need to build from the ground up an initiative that does just that. Right now, we're just piddling around with efforts here and there, some of them strong and dedicated, but the aggregate of which is not even close to what we need to put things together. If we did that, if we had an initiative comparable to the IPCC, the benefits for humanity would be enormous. Because halting and climate change, or stabilizing the world's climate, is vital. And it has productive side to it. In helping to energize a green economy and green innovation. The discovery of the rest of life on Earth, fuller evaluation of it, is going to result in all sorts of very valuable knowledge, products, ways of managing and caring for nature, and extracting information from species that are going to produce new crops, new techniques, biotechnology products, and so on. We haven't begun properly to even explore that in a systematic way globally, and now we should do that.
In your lecture, you say that the age of reduction in biology is over. What do you mean by that?
I just mean the age in which the primary emphasis has been on discovering what parts exist machinery of life. We found out immense amounts about, in the last 50 years especially, which were the glory years of molecular and cell biology, more than 50 years. It became most prominent, in the second half of the 20th century. We found out an immense amount about the parts of cells and how they fit together and so on. The productive part of biology will include more of that, of course. Reductionism is always going to be there. Or I should say reductionist analysis is always going to be in the forefront. But in addition, we have to now add a new age or a new major effort of synthesis. And that's understanding the complex systems, seeing how they fit together. And that goes all the way from understanding the cell thoroughly and as a working system, but all the way up to organisms, how they're constructed, and how they fit together to make ecosystems, to create the biosphere. There'll be a lot of connecting of points, points that are known separately, that now need to be connected up as where they fit into the organization of life. and the levels of organization, much of the future of life, or the study of life, is going to be understanding more fully what are called the major transitions of evolution. And these are across the levels of biological organization, going from molecules to the cell, cells to organisms, organisms to ecosystems are among the great transitions. And this is what biology will be focusing on very substantially, in addition to the familiar and traditional ways of reducing systems in order to understand their parts.
We're nearly at the climax of Darwin Year, the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin. It seems a good time to reflect about why the argument is so heated, and why, particularly in the US, there are so many people who really don't accept Darwin's arguments. I mean, you personally have done a lot, you know, including one of your books, tried to kind of reach out to people in faith communities and sort of say, you know, we don't need to be enemies on this. Why do you think it is that so few people, well, so many people seem to reject his arguments?
I've given a lot of thought as to why Americans are anti-evolution. And it has a lot to do with America's pioneer tradition. That is to say, when we left mother country and from various parts of Europe initially, and then settled North America, there were cities, of course, that sprang up, but most of America was created during the last 200 years by the spread of people westward. And they first settled the land in small communities. These small communities did not have great cathedrals. They didn't have bishops. They didn't have major libraries and theologians. They had just their little farms and the centers where they could gather together. And they had to have a religion that would bind them together, but that could be understood, and that there would be a single authority, you know, as in a hierarchical religion, that could provide information about the nature of the world and the nature of human existence and morality. And there was only one such source that could be used outside, not being in the European cities or under that type of hierarchical, centuries-old influence, and that was the Bible. So they became biblical literalists, or much closer to it than Europeans. And biblical literalism leads to fundamentalism, and to introduce a extraordinarily radical reassessment of what humanity is and where we came from. And that's what Darwin did. It's unacceptable to a large percentage of them, and still remains that way. Nothing is going to easily change their minds because their culture is woven out of that kind of dependence upon Bible literalism. I don't know whether that fits well with you, and I've never heard that particular view expressed. You know, but I think that's correct.